This is Halleck Hoffman speaking from the Center for the Study of Democratic Institutions in Santa Barbara. The Center, now the principal project of the Fund for the Republic, was established to clarify basic questions of freedom and justice, especially those raised by the emerging power of 20th century institutions. The Center is currently examining such fields as the economic order, the political process, science and technology, communications, law, labor, the American character, war, and peace. The method of study is dialogue and discussion. The staff members of the center meet almost daily to talk among themselves and with visitors and specialists in a variety of fields. To celebrate the 10th anniversary of the Fund for the Republic, the Center for the Study of Democratic Institutions recently invited a select group of West Coast residents to participate in a two-day symposium devoted to the prospects for democracy in the coming decade. Among those participating in the symposium were Aldous Huxley, Jonas Salk, Harrison Brown, Professor of Geochemistry, California Institute of Technology, Paul G. Hoffman, Managing Director of the Special Fund of the United Nations, Kenneth Boulding, Professor of Economics at the University of Michigan, and Associate Justice William O. Douglas of the United States Supreme Court, and other consultants and members of the staff. The broadcast you are about to hear was part of the first day's proceedings. It includes the entire text of Aldous Huxley's remarks and a short excerpt from the discussion that followed. The chairman of the center, Robert M. Hutchins, introduces Mr. Huxley.
We open our symposium this morning. The definition of symposium in the dictionary is a drinking party with conversation. This is said to be, however, the ancient Greek definition. The deterioration since Greek times is indicative of the fact that we have conversation with drinking parties on the side. They will come along in due course. A Protestant ethic does not permit a drinking party at this hour. Now, it is highly appropriate that we should open this discussion of the impact of science and technology on democratic institutions by presenting the man who first saw it all. In Brave New World, in Brave New World Revisited, Mr. Huxley has indicated the problems that we are now going to discuss. All of my generation were brought up on Chrome Yellow and Andy Kay, written by a brilliant young aesthete in England, who since that time has retained the brilliance of his style and penetration, but has moved on even more interesting subjects than those with which he dealt in the carefree 20s. Mr. Huxley is a constant attendant, I'm happy to say, at our discussions in Santa Barbara. And now that we're beginning, the most important one we ever had, I'm glad to have him here to introduce him, Mr. Huxley.
May I remain sitting? Because it's I'm going to have to read with a glass.
If you can sit loud, you can remain
sitting. All right,
sitting.
I can sit loud. I'll try and sit loud, because I have difficulty in reading. The title of this thing is Democratic Institutions in the Context of Advancing Science and Technology, a sort of general introduction to this subject. In politics, the central and fundamental problem is the problem of power. Who is to exercise power, and by what authority, with what purpose in view, and under what controls? Yes, under what controls? For as history has made it abundantly clear, to possess power is ipso facto to be tempted to abuse it. In mere self-preservation, we must create and maintain institutions that make it difficult for the powerful to be led into those temptations which, when succumbed to, transform them into tyrants at home and imperialists abroad. For this purpose, what kind of institutions are effective, and having created them, how can we guarantee them against obsolescence? Circumstances change, and as they change, the old, the once so admirably effective devices for controlling power, cease to be adequate. What then? Specifically, when advancing science and acceleratingly progressive technology alter man's long-standing relationships with the planet on which he lives, revolutionize his societies, and at the same time equip his rulers with new and immensely more powerful instruments of domination, what ought we to do? What can we do? Very briefly, let us review the situation in which we now find ourselves, and in the light of present facts, hazard a few guesses about the future. On the biological level, advancing science and technology have set going a revolutionary process that seems to be destined for the next century at least, perhaps for much longer, to exercise a decisive influence upon the destinies of all societies and their individual members. In the course of the last 50 years, extremely effective methods for lowering the prevailing rates of infant and adult mortality were developed by Western scientists. These methods were very simple and could be applied with the expenditure of very little money by very small numbers of not very highly trained technicians. For these reasons, and because everyone regards life as intrinsically good and death as intrinsically bad, they were in fact applied on a worldwide scale. The results were spectacular. In the past, high birth rates were balanced by high death rates. Thanks to science, death rates have been halved, but except in the most highly industrialized, contraceptive-using countries, birth rates remain as high as ever. An enormous and accelerating increase in human numbers has been the inevitable consequence. At the beginning of the Christian era, so demographers assure us, our planet supported a human population of about 250 million. When the Pilgrim Fathers stepped ashore, the figure had risen to about 500 million. We see then that in the relatively recent past, it took 1,600 years for the human species to double its numbers. Today, world population stands at 3,000 million. By the year 2000, unless something appallingly bad or miraculously good should happen in the interval, 6,000 million of us will be sitting down to breakfast every morning. In a word, 12 times as many people are destined to double their numbers in 1/40th of the time. And this is not the whole story. In many areas of the world, human numbers are increasing at a rate much higher than the average for the whole species. In India, for example, the rate of increase is now 2.3% per annum. By 1990, its 450 million inhabitants will have become 900 million inhabitants. A comparable rate of increase will raise the population of China to the billion mark by about 1980. In Ceylon, in Egypt, in many of the countries of South and Central America, human numbers are increasing at an annual rate of 3%. The result will be a doubling of their present populations in approximately 23 years. On the social, political, and economic levels, what is likely to happen in an underdeveloped country whose population doubles itself in a single generation or even less? An underdeveloped society is a society without adequate capital resources, for capital is what is left over after primary needs have been satisfied, and in underdeveloped countries, most people never satisfy their primary needs. It is also a society without a sufficient force of trained teachers, administrators, and technicians, a society with few or no industries and few or no developed sources of industrial power, a society, finally, with enormous arrears in food production, education, road building, housing, and sanitation to be made good. A quarter of a century from now, when there will be twice as many of them as there are today, what is the likelihood that the members of such a society will be better fed, better housed, clothed, and schooled than at present? And what are the chances in such a society for the maintenance, if they already exist, or the creation, if they do not exist, of democratic institutions? Not long ago, Mr. Eugene Black, the president of the World Bank, expressed the opinion that it would be extremely difficult, perhaps even impossible, For an underdeveloped country with a very rapid rate of population increase, to achieve full industrialization, all its resources, he pointed out, would be absorbed year by year in the task of supplying, or not quite supplying, the primary needs of its new members. Merely to stand still, merely to maintain its current subhumanly inadequate standard of living, will require hard work and the expenditure of all the nation's available capital. Available capital may be increased by loans and gifts from abroad, but in a world where the industrialized nations are involved in a power politics and an increasingly expensive armament race, there will never be enough foreign aid to make much difference. And even if the loans and gifts to underdeveloped countries were to be substantially increased, any resulting gains would be largely nullified by the uncontrolled population explosion. If Mr. Black is correct, and there are plenty of economists and demographers who share his opinion, the outlook for most of the world's newly independent and economically non-viable nations is gloomy indeed. To those that have shall be given. Within the next 10 or 20 years, if war can be avoided, poverty will almost have disappeared from the highly industrialized and contraceptive-using societies of the West. Meanwhile, in the underdeveloped and uncontrolledly breeding societies of Asia, Africa, and Latin America, the condition of the masses, twice as numerous a generation from now as they are today, will have become no better and may even be decidedly worse than it is at present. Such a decline is foreshadowed by current statistics of the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations. In some underdeveloped regions of the world, we are told, people are somewhat less adequately fed, clothed, and housed than were their parents and grandparents 30 and 40 years ago. And what of elementary education? UNESCO recently provided an answer. Since the end of World War II, heroic efforts have been made to teach the whole world how to read. The population explosion has largely stultified these efforts. The absolute number of illiterates is greater now than at any time in the past. The contraceptive revolution, which, thanks to advancing science and technology, has made it possible for the highly developed societies of the West to offset the consequences of birth control by a planned control of births, has had as yet no effect upon the family life of people in underdeveloped countries. This is not surprising. Death control, as I have already remarked, is easy, cheap, and can be carried out by a small force of technicians. Birth control, on the other hand, is rather expensive, involves the whole adult population, and demands of those who practice it a good deal of forethought and directed willpower. To persuade hundreds of millions of men and women to abandon their tradition-hallowed views of sexual morality, then to distribute and teach them to make use of contraceptive devices or fertility-controlling drugs, this is a huge and difficult task. So huge and so difficult that it seems very unlikely that it can be successfully carried out within a sufficiently short space of time in any of the countries where control of birth rate is most urgently needed. Extreme poverty, when combined with ignorance, breeds that lack of desire for better things which has been called wantlessness, the resigned acceptance of a subhuman lot. But extreme poverty, when it is combined with the knowledge that some societies are affluent, breeds envious desires and the expectation that these desires must of necessity and very soon be satisfied. By means of the mass media, those easily exportable products of advancing science and technology, some knowledge of what life is like in affluent societies has been widely disseminated among the world's underdeveloped regions. But alas, the science and technology which have given the industrial West its cars, refrigerators, and contraceptives, have given the people of Asia, Africa, and Latin America only movies and radio broadcasts, which they are too simple-minded to be able to criticize, together with a population explosion, which they are still too poor and too tradition-bound to be able to control by deliberate family planning. In the context of a 3% or even of a mere 2% annual increase in numbers, high expectations are foredoomed to disappointment. From disappointment through resentful frustration to widespread social unrest, the road is short. Shorter still is the road from social unrest through chaos to dictatorship, possibly of the Communist Party, more probably of generals and colonels. It would seem then that for two-thirds of the human race, and the two-thirds of the human race now suffering from the consequences of uncontrolled breeding in a context of industrial backwardness, poverty, and illiteracy, the prospects for democracy during the next 10 or 20 years are poor in the extreme. From underdeveloped societies and the probable political consequences of their explosive increase in numbers, we now pass to the prospects for democracy in the fully industrialized, contraceptive-using societies of the West. It used to be assumed that political freedom was a necessary precondition of scientific research. Ideological dogmatism and dictatorial institutions were supposed to be incompatible with the open-mindedness and the freedom of experimental action, in the absence of which discovery and invention are impossible. Recent history has proved these comforting assumptions to be completely unfounded. It was under Stalin that Russian scientists developed the A-bomb and a few years later the H-bomb. And it is under a more than Stalinist dictatorship that Chinese scientists are now in process of performing the same feat. Another disquieting lesson of recent history is that in a developing society, science and technology can be used exclusively for the enhancement of military power, not at all for the benefit of the masses. Russia has demonstrated, and China is now doing its best to demonstrate, that poverty and primitive conditions of life for the overwhelming majority of the population are perfectly compatible with the wholesale production of the most advanced and sophisticated military hardware. Indeed, it is by deliberately imposing poverty on the masses that the rulers of developing industrial nations are able to create the capital necessary for building an armament industry and maintaining a well-equipped army with which to play their part in the suicidal game of international power politics. We see then that democratic institutions and libertarian traditions are not at all necessary to the progress of science and technology, and that such progress does not of itself make for human betterment at home and peace abroad. Only where democratic institutions already exist, only where the masses can vote their rulers out of office and so compel them to pay some attention to the popular will, are science and technology used for the benefit of the majority as well as for increasing the power of the state. And even where democratic institutions exist, science, technology, and preparation for war combine to pose a serious threat to civil and political liberty. A few days before he left the White House, President Eisenhower delivered a farewell address in which he urged his fellow countrymen to guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. And he added that we must never let the weight of this military-industrial combination endanger our liberties or our democratic processes. Most human beings prefer a measure of freedom to being constantly pushed around, prefer peace to war, and would much rather be alive than dead. But in every part of the world, in democratically organized countries, as well as in countries under dictatorships, men and women have been brought up to regard nationalism as axiomatic and war between nations as something cosmically ordained by God or fate or the essential nature of things. Prisoners of their culture, the masses, even in those countries where they are free to vote, are prevented by the basic postulates in terms of which they do their thinking and their feeling from summarily decreeing an end to the collective paranoia that governs international relations. As for the world's ruling minorities, by the very fact of their position and their power, they are chained even more closely to the current systems of ideas and the prevailing political customs. For this reason, they are even less capable than their subjects of expressing the simple human preference for life and peace. Someday, let us hope, rulers and ruled will break out of the cultural prison in which they are now confined. Someday, and may that day come soon, for thanks to our rapidly advancing science and technology, we have very little time at our disposal. The river of change flows ever faster, and somewhere downstream, perhaps only a few years ahead, we shall come to the rapids, shall hear louder and ever louder the roaring of a cataract. Modern war is a product of advancing science and technology. Conversely, advancing science and technology are products of modern war. Nuclear fusion and nuclear fission have revolutionized war, but it was in order to wage war more effectively that first the United States, then Britain and the USSR, financed the crash programs that resulted so quickly in the harnessing of atomic forces, primarily for military purposes, and secondarily, as a byproduct of the A-bomb, as a source of industrial power. Again, it was primarily for military purposes that the techniques of automation, which are now in process of revolutionizing industrial production and the whole system of administrative and bureaucratic control, were first developed. During World War II, writes Mr. John Diebold, the theory and use of feedback was studied in great detail by a number of scientists both in this country and in Britain. The introduction of rapidly moving aircraft very quickly made traditional gun laying techniques of anti-aircraft warfare obsolete. As a result, a large part of scientific manpower in this country was directed towards the development of self-regulating devices and systems to control our military equipment. It is out of this work that the technology of automation, as we understand it today, has developed. The headlong rapidity with which scientific and technological changes, with all their disturbing consequences in the fields of politics and social relations, are taking place, is due in large measure to the fact that both in the USA and the USSR, research in pure and applied science is lavishly financed by military planners whose first concern is the development of bigger and better weapons in the shortest possible time. In the frantic effort on one side of the Iron Curtain to keep up with the Joneses, on the other side to keep up with the Ivanovs, these military planners spend gigantic sums on research and development. The military revolution advances under forced draft, and as it goes forward, it initiates an uninterrupted succession of industrial, social, and political revolutions. It is against this background of chronic upheaval that the members of a species biologically and historically adapted to a slowly changing environment must now live out their bewildered lives. Old-fashioned war was incompatible while it was being waged with democratic institutions. Nuclear war, if it is ever waged, will prove in all likelihood to be incompatible with civilization and perhaps with human survival. Meanwhile, what of the preparations for nuclear war? If certain physicists and military planners had their way, democracy, where it exists, would be replaced by a system of regimentation centered upon the bomb shelter. The entire population would have to be systematically drilled in the ticklish operation of going underground at a moment's notice, systematically exercised in the art of living troglodytically under conditions resembling those in the hold of an 18th century slave ship. The notion fills most of us with horror, but if we fail to break out of the ideological prison of our nationalistic and bellicose culture, we may find ourselves compelled by the military consequences of our science and technology to descend into the steel and concrete dungeons of total and totalitarian civil defense. In the past, one of the most effective guarantees of liberty was governmental inefficiency. The spirit of tyranny was always willing, but its technical and organizational flesh was generally weak. Today, the flesh is as strong as the spirit. Governmental organization is a fine art based upon scientific principles and disposing of marvelously efficient equipment. 50 years ago, an armed revolution still had some chance of success. In the context of modern weaponry, a popular uprising is foredoomed. Crowds armed with rifles and homemade grenades are no match for tanks. And it is not only in its armament that a modern government owes, to its armament that a modern government owes its overwhelming power. It also possesses the strength of superior knowledge derived from its communication systems, its stores of accumulated data, its batteries of computers, its network of inspection and administration. Where democratic institutions exist and the masses can vote their rulers out of office, the enormous powers with which science, technology, and the arts of organization have endowed the ruling minority are used with some discretion and a decent regard for civil and political liberty. Where the masses can exercise no control over their rulers, these powers are used without compunction to enforce ideological orthodoxy and to strengthen the dictatorial state. The nature of science and technology is such that it is peculiarly easy for a dictatorial government to use them for its own anti-democratic purposes. Well-financed, equipped, and organized, an astonishingly small number of scientists and technologists can achieve prodigious results. The crash program which produced the A-bomb and ushered in a new era, historical era, was planned and directed by some 4,000 theoreticians, experimenters, and engineers. To parody the words of Winston Churchill, never have so many been so completely at the mercy of so few. Throughout the 19th century, the state was relatively feeble, and its interest in and influence upon scientific research was negligible. In our day, the state is everywhere exceedingly powerful, and everywhere a lavish patron of basic and ad hoc research. In Western Europe and North America, the relations between the state and its scientists on the one hand, and individual citizens, professional organizations, industrial, commercial, and educational institutions on the other, are fairly satisfactory. Advancing science, the population explosion, the armament race, and the steady increase and centralization of political and economic power are still compatible in countries that have a libertarian tradition with democratic forms of government. To maintain this compatibility in a rapidly changing world, bearing less and less resemblance to the world in which these democratic institutions were developed, this quite obviously is going to be an increasingly difficult. A rapid and accelerating population increase that will nullify the best efforts of underdeveloped societies to better their lot and will keep two-thirds of the human race in a condition of misery in anarchy or of misery under dictatorship. And the intensive preparations for a new kind of war that, if it breaks out, may bring irretrievable ruin to the one-third of the human race, now living prosperously in highly industrialized societies. These are the two main threats to democracy now confronting us. Can these threats be eliminated, or if not eliminated, at least reduced? My own view is that it is only by shifting our collective attention from the merely political to the basic biological aspects of the human situation that we can hope to mitigate and shorten the time of troubles into which it would seem we are now moving. We have to get it into our collective head that the basic problem now confronting us is ecological. How does the human race propose to survive and, if possible, better the lot of all its members? Do we propose to live on this planet in symbiotic harmony with our environment, or preferring to be wantonly stupid, shall we choose to live like murderous and suicidal parasites that kill their host and so destroy themselves? It might be sensible to think less about the problem of landing a couple of astronauts on the moon and rather more about the problem of enabling 3 billion men, women, and children, who in less than 40 years will be 6 billions, to lead a tolerably human existence without, in the process, ruining and befouling their planetary environment. Indeed, I believe that it is only by cultivating this kind of ecological thinking that we shall be able to reduce the threat of war. Rationalized and justified in terms of national ideals and dogmatic ideology, power politics raises problems that, except by war, are almost insoluble. The problems of ecology, on the other hand, admit of a rational solution and can be tackled without arousing the violent passions always associated with nationalism and ideology. There may be arguments about the best way of raising wheat in a cold climate or of reforesting a denuded mountain, but such arguments never lead to organized slaughter. Organized slaughter is the result of arguments about such questions as the following: which is the best nation, the best religion, the best political theory, and the best form of government? Why are other people so stupid and wicked? Why can't they see how good and intelligent we are? Why do they resist our beneficent efforts to bring them under our control and make them like ourselves? To questions of this kind, the final answer has always been war. War, said Clausewitz, is not merely a political act. It is a real political instrument, a continuation of previous political relationships, a continuation of policy by other means. This was true enough in the 1820s, when Clausewitz wrote his famous treatise, and it continued to be more or less true until 1945. Now, pretty obviously, nuclear weapons, long-range rockets, nerve gases, bacterial aerosols, and the laser, that highly promising latest addition to the world's military arsenals, have given the lie to Clausewitz. All-out war with modern weapons is no longer a continuation of previous policy. It is a complete and irreversible break with previous policy. Power politics, nationalism, and dogmatic ideology are luxuries which the human race can no longer afford. Nor, as a species, can we afford the luxury of ignoring man's ecological situation. By shifting our attention from the now completely irrelevant and anachronistic politics of nationalism and military power to the problems of the human species and the still inchoate politics of human ecology, we shall be killing two birds with one stone, reducing the threat of sudden destruction by scientific war, and at the same time reducing the threat of more gradual biological disaster. In the process of reducing these twin threats, we shall find, no doubt, that we have done something in President Wilson's prematurely optimistic words to make the world safe for democracy.
Huxley sees three problems: population, arms race, nationalism, and believes that we should shift our attention from politics to ecology in order to engage in arguments which will not result in war and to divert our attention from those arguments which are certain to result in war. I would like to begin by asking Mr. Huxley for an item of clarification. As he sounded his original attack on politics, he made it very comprehensive indeed. He said, "Let us shift our attention from politics to ecology." He said later, and it relieved me somewhat, that what he wanted us to do was to shift our attention from the politics of nationalism and military power to ecology. And I assume all this that when you say you want us to shift our attention from politics, you do not want us to shift our attention from the problem of how you make government intelligent and effective, or from the problem of how you make democracy work, but precisely what you said the second time, that you want to get out of a kind of politics that focuses around nationalism and military power.
Well, I did speak about the still inchoate politics of ecology. I mean, it seems to me that we simply, as a matter of self-preservation, we have to consider the problem of man, the species. After all, we've already been using this word man here without defining what we mean. It has three major meanings. I mean, man can refer to the species as a whole. Man can refer to the average behavior of human beings within a given culture. Or else man can be the locus of unshareable experiences of each individual. And, I mean, of course, one of the great sort of secrets of philosophical writing is to muddle up the three meanings and never to explain exactly what you're saying, so that almost anything can be proved when you talk about man. But the problem is, can we reconcile the basic desires and tendencies and potentialities of man, the locus of immediate experiences, with what man is doing as the beneficiary and the victim of culture? And how can this all be, these two things, be related to the fate, the destiny of the species as a whole? And there is, it seems to me, I mean, of course we can't do without politics, but I mean, what are we doing politics for? I mean, are we doing it for the survival of the species as a whole, or for the survival of a particular national group? I mean, are we going to indulge in nationalistic idolatry, or are we going to have some sort of overall humanistic view, which entails, as well as the cultural, our cultural preoccupations, the preoccupation with the destiny of man as a whole and with the destiny of man as an individual? I mean, all that I meant was that the sort of basic frame of reference in which political activities shall take place shall be less culture-bound and more ecology-bound, so to say.
I saw a remarkable link-up between politics and ecology the other day. A bumper strip on an automobile said, "Keep Mars an ecological preserve."
Well, it may not be a bad idea.
Yes.
Do
you have a question?
Yes, Dr. There's been so much talk about change relating it to the problem of our society. Is there any evidence at all there's been any change in man? And I'll accept any one of Mr. Huxley's three definitions or three characterizations. And if there hasn't been, there isn't any evidence of any fundamental change in any one of those three characterizations of man. Any real basis for believing that we're going anywhere toward, except toward self-destruction? The fact is that this society is probably more advanced in its respect for human dignity than any society in a long time, in numerical terms at least. Now, there's also a fact that in this very advanced and sophisticated society, with groups like this thinking about people and their problems, you have some of the leading figures in the United States who will argue that, in all seriousness, that colored children ought not to be permitted to go to school with white children. Now, this is okay in 1860, I suppose, and it's okay perhaps today in Southeast Asia, and maybe it's even okay 10 years ago.
Well, isn't the evidence of change the fact that Plessy against Ferguson has been overruled? And that what the sentiments that you express is now held by a minority of the people were once held by almost everybody. Well, and can't you see similar social changes taking place all over the world in very recent history, such as the complete transformation of England from a sink of bribery and iniquity in the 18th century into a model of administrative purity in the 19th?
This seemed to me kind of superficial.
Well, they're no more superficial than the one you selected yourself, which was the attitude toward the Negro in the South. Well, I say that as change, and there's no indication. If that's a good example, well, why not say it's evidence of change?
But the real fact, it hasn't it? I mean, one of the real forces of society made it happen. The court's made an adjustment in its thinking.
Well, I say that it's not...
And that's a change, I'll grant you.
Supreme, Mr. Dooley used to say that the Supreme Court followed the election returns. I think that was perhaps a little too specific, but we would say, wouldn't we, that the Supreme Court is affected somewhat by changes in public opinion. Mr. Wayne?
I think what my friend over there was trying to say was, and what I'm inclined to say myself in part at least, is that aren't changes taking place in our environment so much more rapidly than the evolutionary changes in man? These changes are taking place so rapidly that we're worried that man won't be able to take these changes in his stride without shattering him and completely alienating him from his existence. This is what's bothering us.
May I make one or two remarks? It is, of course, obviously we're under the pressure of excessively great changes, but I think one of the extraordinary things about the human being is its capacity for adapting to entirely novel things. I'm old enough to remember having seen, as a very small child, Queen Victoria going for her evening afternoon constitutional in Windsor Park. She was in a bath chair with a very fat pony and equerries at the side, and travelling at about 2.5 miles an hour. I mean, this is what one regarded as the normal speed for old ladies at that time. Well, now you can see ladies of comparable age and dignity stepping on the gas along the freeway. I mean, who would have conceived that at that time that these elderly people could possibly do the things that in fact they are doing now? This is absolutely extraordinary. This, of course, confirms what Dr. Salk was saying about the enormous potentialities which still lie waiting for actualization in the human mind. But it is quite extraordinary, if one has lived long enough, as I have, to remember London and Paris without one single vehicle which was not horse-drawn, and to see now this extraordinary capacity, which no one suspected at that time, for immensely rapid reactions, for the control of very, very powerful machines. There is no doubt that although we are under the terrible stress at the present time, that we have extraordinary capacities for adaptation. I mean, one of the tragedies is to see that many young people, hardly out of college, have developed what may be called a kind of mental arteriosclerosis 40 years before they develop physical arteriosclerosis. On the other hand, you see people 90 years old like Bertrand Russell. I mean, the last time I saw Russell, he made a wonderful remark. It was at my brother's house, and my brother was talking about some curious fact of animal behavior. Russell listened very carefully, and he said, "How nice it is to know things."
You have been listening to Aldous Huxley discuss the impact of science and technology on democratic institutions. This broadcast was part of the first day's proceedings during a recent symposium at the Center for the Study of Democratic Institutions in Santa Barbara to examine the prospects for democracy in the coming decade. Mr. Huxley's paper will shortly be published under the title, The Politics of Ecology. If you would like a copy, please write Box 4068 in Santa Barbara. Ask for The Politics of Ecology. The opinions expressed in this broadcast were those of the speakers. The Center is responsible only for making the material available in the interest of widening the circles of discussion of crucial issues of our time. This is Hal Kaufman in Santa Barbara.